Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, I am joined by Rachel Friedman, the owner of A Better Pet, a pet training organization with a subspecialty in service dogs. And she is part of our mini series on learning all about the world of service dogs for those with mitochondrial disease. So thank you, Rachel. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for inviting me to be joining you on this lovely, cold, frigid winter day to talk about my favorite topic. So I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Thank you. So let's kick it off. Now, have you always worked in this field of dog training and service dog training and pet training?
Well, there's a sort of yes and no answer to that. But the reality is my interest in all things animal started from my earliest memory. And stories have been told of things I did prior to my memory that involved just observing behavior. It's always been a fascination of mine. And I was raised in a home where we had dogs growing up, but there wasn't like, I wasn't directly responsible for them or wasn't the one that was the most attached to them. They were family dogs, and my parents presumably did all the training of them while I was a little kid. But I did grow up with the opportunity to work with horses and worked with a guy who I just learned just within the last week. I received information from a friend growing up in this place that this guy had died at the age of 87. I knew him he was in his 30s, and he was a cowboy. He was a Vietnam vet cowboy, but he was very important to me in terms of teaching me how you could raise and train and socialize an animal with positive behaviors instead of punitive behaviors. And so that was a very big impact. So training animals, I trained horses in my teen years, which was really rewarding. But I meandered my way through my college years, a lot of international travel, a lot of fits and starts with getting through college. And halfway through my undergraduate degree, I decided I would get myself a dog as a 21st birthday gift for myself. And I credit that dog with being the biggest mentor I had. And she got me through college and she got through me through my 20s. And I would say that I had a very, you know, I was really all over the place in my 20s. I moved frequently between the time I left my parents' house and I moved into the house I live in now. I moved 28 times.
Oh my gosh.
And she moved with me in most of them. Not all of them, but most of them. And she really was, in hindsight, my psychiatric service dog. She got me through all the kinds of challenges young people have when you're being told you're an adult, but you don't really know how to be doing adulting yet. She was instrumental in keeping me grounded and focused and confident. And people, I would say, preferred her far more than they preferred me. But I was it was a package deal, right? And so I would say, what happened was I got my master's in social work in my late 20s, early 30s. And I worked in the field of mental health for the most part, working in inpatient hospitals, outpatient places, group, children, adults, families, et cetera, and a variety of different social work jobs. And I was at my last one I had just had my third child. And I had gone back to work, and all I complained about was, I just want to be a dog trainer. I just want to be a dog trainer. Apropos of really nothing. That was just what I decided I wanted to be. And one of my coworkers said, well, why don't you just do it? And I said, well, okay, I will. And so without a plan, you know, three little kids, I started doing dog training on the side. And it was very, very part-time. There was a vet I worked with who was very generous in offering me the lobby of his vet hospital, as well as this kind of fenced in, not fenced in, but kind of guarded outdoor area And I asked if I could teach dog training classes in the lobby. And he said, well, let's give it a go. And it was for him, it gave him something to offer his clientele. And for me, it was an opportunity to just try different things. I mean, I have some really good stories about things that I practiced in that teaching of two different classes over many years on how to use just the power of suggestion to help people better understand why they're being asked to do something while living in a reality-based universe. And so that's a big part of the way I teach people, is for them to be able to live with their dog in a reality-based universe, not just inside a building where you're meeting without the same kinds of real-life distractions that happen in the world. And I taught at a number of different places over the years. But I started the company in 1999, which is the year my daughter was born. And by 2000, I had become an LLC, which is a limited liability company corporation. Got my vendor license, and I've been at it ever since. I'm in my 26th year now.
That's incredible.
It seems like you've really connected so deeply with many of your trainees. Tell me about your training model, how one goes about inquiring and just like starting the process with you.
Well, I've been doing this now. I placed my first service dog that I acquired in 2000, then kept her for 2 years and placed her in 2002. So when you do something long enough, you know, you become like a big fish in a little pond. Because I bring, you know, I have a master's in social work. And so the development of my own business model was predicated or based a lot on the social services model that I learned. And the natural kind of veering into the sidebar, if you will, of service dog training was based on wanting to develop a more consistent relationship. Now, what's interesting in my own development, and where I kind of made a leap into being, as you describe, more connected with my clients. I raised three daughters, and for most of those years, I was a single parent. And so I wanted them to believe I didn't work from the perspective that I could attend every parent-teacher conference or every activity, show, sports thing, whatever. But while I could still work all the time in between making myself available when they needed me. And I wanted to save my emotional energy for them. And so my model at the time, before I got heavily into the service dog ramp up, if you will, was doing kind of short-term relationships with people in dog training. I'd work with them a couple times at the most and then kind of get them on their way. Well, I also created a program I call Dip or Drop in Play, where everyone who goes through, whether it's pet or therapy or service dog training, are eligible. And this is really particularly for when dogs are under three, which is really most of the time when people are reaching out, they're actually reaching out with a younger dog. And the older dogs would not necessarily need or be appropriate for a drop-in play, but from the perspective of wanting to socialize and help normalize dogs with their own kind, it was this free add-on that people got a lifetime access to for free if they went through private training with me. So it helped foster a community. And so as I met people and they were bringing their dogs to Dip, and they'd meet other people bringing their dogs to Dip, and I was creating longer term relationships, because when I do a full, I call it the full Monty, when I do a full service dog agreement, it's a 6-month agreement. I'm providing services to them excessively. They have access to me like all the time. We have regularly scheduled online meetings, in-person meetings, public access outings, text exchanges when they have a little issue, or phone calls if that's necessary. And so they can get an answer to their questions all the time. And that helps kind of tweak them into understanding how to navigate the relationship with their service dog. So the model that really evolved was that I would acquire puppies from breeders that I liked, and I would get them somewhere between 8 weeks to maybe no more than 12 weeks old. I would raise them, and I would either have already acquired a person who wants to go through this, and we acquired a dog specifically for them, which is also one of my superpowers, is helping people pick the right make and model. And especially when you're dealing with challenges like medical conditions or mobility challenges, or really very overwhelming psychiatric issues like depression and trauma and anxiety and things that just make it hard to function.
So they get access to you for 6 months. So how does it start? I imagine you drive the bus at the beginning and, you know, give them a lot of information and advice and insight.
Well, it's evolved. So I'm going to kind of walk you through where I'm at now with the way I do it, because my services has evolved to include people who would want to do this and might be able to do it with a 1/10 the kind of intensity. So the people would in the beginning come to me. We would decide if we could work together, which was a process of discussion. When we agreed to work together, we would sign an agreement. The agreement would stipulate what the terms of the agreement were, which would include whether I needed to find them the right make and model and then raise and train it and place it with them at some point, usually 2 to 3 months later. And then as it got further along and my kids were growing up and my kids went off to college and left me and I became an empty nester. And as they started, I had three, so they didn't all go off at the same time. But as they started to go off on their own, I engaged in more of these long-term relationships because I had the emotional energy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I traded the emotional energy I was giving my children for my, you know, very frequently I would be working with young people, not always, but frequently it would be young people. So they were kind of like my children in a way. And then in 2018, I actually decided, well, why don't I just breed my own dogs? Because I have amazing dogs. And so that's when I started doing what I call hobby breeding. And the hobby breeding was I first bred my dog, Franny, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And she had three puppies. I still have one of them. The other two are service dogs. Then in 2021, and they're about to celebrate their fourth birthday in the next week or so, I had a litter of six puppies from Franny that were half poodle and half English Springer Spaniel, which is what Franny was, an English Springer Spaniel. And so I had now a non-shedding dog that brought all the wonderful qualities of the English Springer and the poodle together into like just very loving, love people, love to work, easy to connect, low shed to no shed. So they address a lot of issues people might have.
Yeah.
Allergies or any kinds of problems where it might make it easier to bring a dog into a work environment knowing that it was non-shedding. And then in 23, Pinto, who I kept from that litter, it's a theme here. Do you hear it? She had a litter of six puppies and they all went. No, I'm sorry. In her first litter, she had four puppies. Three are service dogs. I kept one. Not as a service dog prospect. He's a very different kind of fellow. I love him, but he's just not the sharpest pencil in the pack. He's just got an incredible heart and a very good sense of humor. And then in 2024, I had a litter of 10 puppies. And I still have two. They're available as medical alert, mobility support, psychiatric, or all of the above. And there's information on my website about them. I'm fielding inquiries. Now, one of the things about these guys that's different is that they're now almost 8 months old and I've been training them for 8 months, or they've been in training. So they're ready to go. They're like in what I call move-in condition. But I'm very selective because I want it to succeed. And I want to make sure that when I partner them with somebody, they're going to be a person who's going to really follow through with the training. And you learn over time how to accept people who are going to do it. You know, I want them to want it more than I do. And if they don't, they're not going to work out. So my success rate is much better because I'm a little more selective. And in the meantime, while I'm living with them, I'm having great gobs of fun with them. So it's, you know, it's a win-win.
You're so passionate about what you do. It comes through with everything you say. So do you work with clients all over the country?
So what's happening now to accommodate more people, I'm producing an online service dog course that'll be self-guided. And I would say 2/3 of the way of production on it. And I need to find the time to finish it's a 3-module course. And so what I'm doing now instead is I take people on. I was teaching it last summer in groups of like up to 6 to 7 people. And we would do this 12-week course. with breaks in between the modules so they could practice things. And then I discovered that it wasn't a model I really loved for me to do it. So now I'm doing people individually. So now they're doing this course. It's 1/10 the cost of a service dog placement. It's a lot less of my time, but if they follow my directions and they recognize the highs and lows of the process, and they are able to communicate effectively with me, they succeed.
Gotcha.
And, you know, there's always the inevitable person who says, hey, I just got a puppy, or I have a 5-year-old dog and I want to turn it into a psychiatric service dog because I have anxiety. And there are waves of people that come, like when the airplane rules changed, that's when people came and I'm like, well, why do you feel like you need a psychiatric service dog? I just want to fly with the dog. I said, no, I'm not working with you. That's not authentic. You're dismissing and minimizing the real value a service dog brings to somebody. You choose to fly a dog as a service dog and I have nothing to do with you. I don't care as long as your dog is well behaved. But I'm really working with people with serious medical challenges or physical challenges or psychiatric challenges, or very often all three.
So talk to me as if I'm very unfamiliar with service dogs and with dogs and with the process. So would I first go online and submit on your website? Like, is that the first step?
Right. Well, I suggest my website has a ton of information on it. There's information about the
available. So you could get a lot of good early research.
There's videos I share of updates with clients who've worked with me over
time. I love those. Yeah. I learned so much when I was watching those. And you can really see the connection that you've created between you and your clients.
Yeah.
You hit on this for just a second. What do you do when someone comes to you that has a dog, a young dog that wants to train it to be a service animal? Are you supportive of that process?
The first step for any service people would be seeking here would be to fill out a contact us form that is on, I believe, if not every page of my website, you'll find it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that will generate a form to fill out to help us understand what brings you into asking questions. What are you looking for? Be as detailed as possible. Some people give lots of information, which I love, because it really cuts to the chase about whether or not I think this is viable or not. And or they provide just the barest of bones, which doesn't bode well.
Right.
But what that generates is my administrative assistant will follow up with them and offer them an opportunity at no cost to talk to her to do an intake.
Okay.
And then she knows me well enough to help, head them in the correct direction, because generally speaking, and we also talk frequently, so I can tell her this is what I think this person is going to need. So if somebody was interested, for example, in saying they wanted to train their existing dog or new puppy into a service dog, the very first thing would either be to offer them a consult to see if that's really true, or better yet, since they already have the dog, that they should schedule the regular private training. It's a 2-part private training I offer online. For the first one, for sure, which is recorded and they get the recording. And the second part is a follow-up to what we're working on and can be done in person if it's appropriate and they're local. But in those, I do work with people all over the country and in some cases, you know, in other countries as well. As long as you have a Wi-Fi connection, you're good.
Got it. So I know that service dogs can be trained to do so many different tasks. Can you kind of go through some of the tasks that you've worked with clients to train their dogs for?
Well, interesting question, because I have a kind of different philosophy about this. I can always tell when people do fill out a contact us form, when they've copied and pasted, what are some service dog tasks your dog can do? And they'll just copy paste it and it'll say, I want to train the dog to do deep pressure therapy on my chest to mitigate the challenges I get when I get overwhelmed. Okay. So how do I teach the dog to come over, lie on my chest and make it stay there so it can help me? And I'm like, no. That is not how it works. How it works is you develop a relationship with your dog. You get the right make and model who wants to have a relationship with you. and then be able to say to you, hey, I can see you're not feeling well. Let me snuggle up with you and make you feel better. Or, hey, you're spending an awful lot of time in bed. Why don't you try to get up and take me outside and play some fetch with me or something. Dress warm, you know, now that we're in winter. And so when people may be suffering through things and they're being told by their doctors or their support system to do this or do that, they're reluctant to do it. But if a dog is nudging them to do the same thing, they'll do it because this is this being that they're now responsible for. You watch my back, I'll watch yours. And so I just the other day in training, I always take my puppies with me on training outings when they're appropriate. So I had to go to the dentist for teeth cleaning. And I've done this every time I go for teeth cleaning. So they're very familiar. I bring a different dog every time. But I train the dog to either lie down and wait for me, or if I can, and I usually can, even with my big guy here, who's like probably 65 pounds by now, I call him up on the chair as I'm getting my cleaning and they lie on me. And they're like nice and warm and cuddly and I can pet the dog. I don't have anxiety about going to the dentist, but I will tell you, I like it a lot when a warm dog is lying on me and I can just kind of pet his soft, fuzzy ears and tweak his nose and just focus on him. And it makes it better.
And from the training perspective, I'm guessing that a dentist's office is a good place with the different sounds. There's a few people in a close range. So it's good exposure for the dog, correct?
Exactly. All the outings are intended to expose the dog to some kind of challenge and have to be functional. So if you're looking at function, what is the dog's job? When I talk about the relationship, I work with a lot of medical alert dogs. And they just, I basically say to them, okay, this is your partner. You take good care of them. You let them know. And they're immediately working for their person. If you watch the videos, you'll see the stories that these dogs immediately started doing alerting and assisting without being trained. They would say, hey, Rachel, this thing happened. Do you think the dog was alerting me? And I said, well, it sounds very possible. What I would say is, document it, reward the dog for whatever he or she did, and let's keep going on and seeing how it goes. And so I think most dogs can actually tell from our chemical emissions that we give in our bodies what's going on and can tell us, hey, there's something going awry. But the problem is they don't necessarily care to communicate it, or their owners might not recognize it as a communication and they'll quell it. They'll say, don't do this behavior. And they're like, okay. And they're also probably not the right make and model and haven't been raised and trained and socialized the way the dogs I get. People often come to me with dogs that are not trained at all, are not really social, and may have aggressive tendencies even, or protective tendencies, or they don't just really care about their person. They'll sleep in the opposite part of the house from them. And I'm like, don't waste your money and don't waste my time. That's not going to work. Well, I love my dog. I said, well, I'm not telling you can't keep your dog. I'm just telling you I wouldn't, you know, train it to do service work. And I did have one person recently just visited back in the Cleveland area. She had come to me many years ago with a dog she'd gotten that was just a mess. And she said, I want you to help me train this dog. And I said, no. She goes, well, I want to keep him. I love him. I said, of course. So she kept him. 14 years later, he dies. He did some really wacky stuff in his life. And she came back to me. And I partnered her with a dog. She has cerebral palsy, depression, struggles a lot because people dismiss and minimize her because she's different. And she's very lonely because people ignored her. She gets this dog and, oh my gosh, I can't even tell you how 180 degrees her life changed with that dog. And now she ended up quit a job that was destroying her soul. She went to graduate school. She got a master's in counseling. She's now a licensed therapist and her dog comes to work and the dog does therapy for her clients while doing service for her. Triple title, you know, just great friend, service dog, and therapy dog for the clients that she serves. So
wow.
It flew with her for the first time to come back. She moved away, which was just an amazing growth experience for her. and she just came back for the first time by plane because we talked again. This is like, once I'm with people, I'm with them if they want to be. Not all of them need or want to be, but I do connect with a lot of people and I'm always available if they call back. So she actually called me or she texted me shortly before she flew here just to ask a few questions. And I do have a client who came to me with a dog that did work out well. And she needs to fly, I think it's either once or twice a month. I think it's once a month. She has to fly to Minnesota for infusions for a medical condition. And her husband used to go with her, but he was no longer able to because of stuff. And she didn't want him to have to go. So she trained her dog to go with her, and her dog attends the infusions with her, helps give her confidence going by herself because it's kind of overwhelming because she's not completely healthy. She's doing these with the dog. And now she's my expert. And people are flying. I say, I have somebody who will walk you through exactly what she deals with.
That's great.
Yeah. And she loves to be able to help. You know, so we get, when I talked earlier about community.
Yeah.
It's like a community where someone becomes a mentor after they've been mentored.
Yeah.
And it helps them in their own.
A great way to pay it forward.
Yes. Yes. It's very cool. It's very cool. There was a time before COVID happened that I had, I want to say about 8 or 9 young women who all became friends.
Really?
At least for a time. I don't know. I couldn't say if that's still there now, but they really supported each other. They did stuff socially together. They went for walks with their dogs together. It was beautiful.
Huh.
So let's say I'm at this point in my life where I'm faced with a lot of medical challenges, and I've never had a dog before. And I think that maybe it could help me day to day, but I really just don't know how to connect those dots.
Right.
You know, if I were to go through my condition with you and my symptoms and what I have challenged, what my daily challenges are you able to, when you say like the correct make and model, that probably helps you better understand what type of dog would be best for that particular person.
Exactly.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then
not just even size or, well, yeah, because you're looking at what is the role of the dog? Does it need to provide any mobility support?
Mm-hmm.
Does it need to be small enough to go into this place? Does it need to be big enough to do this? So as I became a breeder and I was kind of messing, my last litter were a Springer Doodle and a Sheepadoodle. I've had 2 litters with those 2 paired together, and they make different size dogs. So I have bigger ones for people who need the bigger dogs and medium dogs that are not, you know, where sizes like, you know, smaller dog would be better. So if somebody who comes to me with no knowledge, never had a dog or never really had the experience of training a dog, they're often easier to work with because they haven't got habits that need to be changed. They haven't got a set of beliefs that are wrong, you know, that are based on not science, not truth. And I am all about trying to create programming. I call my teaching program the 6 Pillars of Dog Training Wisdom. And it's a formulaic approach. I've created all these different formulas that if they can memorize and internalize the formulas, they become experts in their dog. So I work with people who have trained dogs, probably not very well, or different kinds of dogs. And so everything is the same. You start by filling out a contact us. We follow up. Some people never follow up back with us. You know, that's okay. They're probably reaching out to a lot of people and that's part of the game, right? And I get a lot, I would say at this point with my service dog stuff, a lot of it is word of mouth.
Do you feel like you have like clusters of people, like, you know, someone in, for example, the mitochondrial community works with you and then maybe they know other people in the community and then they also end up coming to you?
That doesn't happen as a real cluster. It might happen once in a while. I mean, I really draw from the people who are using the right keywords to find me.
Uh-huh.
It's like I feel like I'm out on a big pond or a big lake and I cast out my net, and then sometimes the really perfect people come in. And not everybody who contacts me is obviously going to work out, or they want to do it, but they can't afford it. I'm not a nonprofit. I have different rules. I mean, I think the other unique thing for me in my experience with having both carefully selected puppies from breeders I like, or breeding my own and raising them because I know how to do that, and I make the opportunity, when I have the puppies, I make it my focus to raise them well. 10 was a little daunting last summer, but I did it. It was fun. I counted to 10, probably 1,000 times a day. Are they all here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. Got really good at counting up to 10 very fast. But the, you know, the whole goal is to assess the function. The other thing I would say, like, let me just give you as a quick example to help people understand how a service dog works. Because we the course that I'm producing and the one that I take people on individually and privately is 3 modules. And the first one is all about how do you teach them basic manners and create a reliability of those manners at home and in public, regardless of distractions. And from those basic manners, just like we use the alphabet to make words and words into sentences and sentences into paragraphs, et cetera. So 2, do we take the basic manners and build on those? And then part 2 is about public access behavior. Like, how do you take a dog to all these different locations and have them not only function for you, but also be well-behaved and not impede anybody else's ability to get through space? And then the 3rd section, after you've got your basic manners going really well and you're getting more familiar with all the different things you have to be mindful of in different public situations, then we work on functionality.
Okay.
And functionality are all the things that the dog helped you with.
Uh-huh.
I also want to add on a personal note, and I didn't talk about this for the first few years after this happened, that I've discovered that I'm more removed from it and I'm more comfortable with the impact of it. I've been training service dogs, you know, as I mentioned, I started in 2000. And in 2017, after placing quite a few dogs, and in fact, had a service dog puppy living in my house, I went to yoga one morning and in the middle of my class, I had a stroke and I ended up in the hospital and had lost the use of my left leg and went through a number of tests, could never figure out why it happened, but I couldn't walk. And I went into rehab straight away from, you know, inpatient because I couldn't walk. And by the time I left rehab a couple weeks later, I was able to walk enough to just be independently at home. But what was funny is my daughter, she brought my dog in the day I was in the ER, and my dog, Franny, just flew on the gurney and became my service dog. And when I did get out of the hospital, I trained her in less than 5 minutes to be my support dog by pulling me. She was trained to walk on a loose leash, but I trained her to, on cue, walk with tension on the leash. And the way she would pull me was like a barge, like a tugboat pulling a barge, and she kept me straight because I couldn't walk independently and straight for a long time. It was really hard, but you know, you have to work hard to recover the neural pathways that allow the parts of the leg to move. And in the beginning, I broke my toes several times because I couldn't slow down. I didn't want to slow down. And so I better experience the kinds of frustrations people have when they're raising the dog and they're having, you know, setbacks because they're wanting something faster than it's reasonable to expect it to happen, because we have to let these unfold as they can. And during my rehab, I was actually reviewing videos for my course that were cracking me up. My daughter would come and visit me about every other day with my dog. And because I had a service dog puppy at the time, she'd bring the puppy sometimes. And if she came when I wasn't in physical therapy, I would get in a wheelchair and I would train them in the halls of the inpatient rehab floor. And I was grateful I could actually work while I was in the hospital recovering from a stroke. But it did really impact a lot my understanding of people with different challenges, much specifically, because I could relate to it personally. And so I'm able to share that with people, and that makes them feel more comfortable with working with me also, because I have that shared experience of something medical that happened to me, least, you know, didn't expect it, came out of nowhere, no pre-existing conditions that would have suggested this at all. And boom, your life changes in a heartbeat. But the other reality, and I just want to make sure that it's said in here, if because I think it's relevant. When you talk about the functionality of a dog, let's say it's a mobility assist, kind of like my dog was for a couple, like probably for about a year and a half from it. I needed her help to get me from, let's say, the car into a building, into the waiting room, get up. And then she would have to lie down and wait with me while I'm in the waiting room, waiting room, waiting room, waiting room. I'm sure a lot of the people that listen to this are familiar with waiting rooms, right? And then when they call me in for my appointment, she helps me physically be mobile to get to the appointment. And then when I get to the appointment, if I'm being asked to sit for the appointment, she again is laying down and off duty, only from the respect that she's not doing that function. So a lot of the dog's job is to do nothing. And being able to do nothing no matter what is going on is so much harder than people realize.
Yeah,
it's a dog
that's a really
going
good point.
All these people environments.
Yeah.
And so that early puppyhood stuff is so important. So when people go to a shelter, I have found shelter dogs that would be and became very suitable service dogs because my superpower is I can read dogs very well. And then my second superpower is by that reading, I can match people with dogs very well. But I really want people to realize that the goal that I try to provide is that I start the dog like a starter dough for sourdough.
Yeah.
And then I teach them how to make the bread. And the ironic thing about that,
it's a great way to put it.
It is the way I tell people it is. And it's so funny because a friend's daughter-in-law gave me a jar of sourdough starter and I let it die in my refrigerator. I didn't feed it. So I failed with sourdough, but I still use the metaphor.
You can handle dogs, but not a loaf of bread.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they do get to a point where the training that the dog is now experiencing is wholly theirs because they've learned.
Yeah.
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 It's very
cool. I think you've done a wonderful job explaining how you specifically do it, how people should really be thinking about this. And, you know, hopefully it's piquing their interest, giving them some ideas to think about for themselves or maybe a relative. But it's a really important decision and one that could make life so much easier. And again, you know, I've learned from people in our mitochondrial disease community, as well as a few from your website, to see how valuable having a service dog can be for that person, you know, and how amazing this process can work. So hopefully we have given our listeners more information, which I think is one of the most important parts of having this podcast. So thank you so much, Rachel. Thank you for being here.
Well, it was a pleasure to be here. And thank you for what's always for me a fun conversation.
You're so passionate about what you do. It truly comes through in everything you say.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.